Well, we wrapped up last year with a podcast of the Shoalwater Bay Indian tribe that developed the first freestanding tsunami evacuation structure in the U.S. Keeping with that same theme of earthquake hazards, we're focusing a podcast on Robert DeGroot. He's an operations team lead for the USGS Managed Shake Alert Earthquake Warning System, a public safety system that serves over 50 million people in California, Oregon, and Washington. Hey, everyone, I'm Hurricane Hal, host of the GeoTrek podcast, where we explore the world to bring you stories about extreme weather and natural disasters not covered by the mainstream media. Make sure you subscribe, like, and follow our content online. We love to engage with you to bring you the latest stories that can help you better prepare for disasters, whether it's earthquakes, tornadoes, hurricanes, whatever it is. Listen to the podcast, stay engaged with us on social media. You'll be better prepared for any disasters coming your way. Well, without further introduction, let's jump into this podcast with Robert DeGroot. Bob, thank you so much for taking time to come on the GeoTrek podcast.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Bob, you and your team have this tremendous responsibility to communicate earthquake information to a very large audience. Before we get into talking about your professional work, could you explain to us, like, how did you become interested in earthquakes? Like, did you experience one growing up? Was there an event that got you excited about them? Or what's your background and how you got into earthquakes?
Yeah, my first experience was an earthquake when it was 3 years old. It was the 1971 San Fernando earthquake. It was a magnitude 6.6. And I didn't know anything about earthquakes. I was a little guy. I was in bed with my parents. And the building started shaking. And they started screaming. And I was freaking out because I didn't know what it was. And then lots of things fell and broke. And it was really just sort of that, I don't know, sort of moment of like, what just happened? And of course, then I identified it with earthquakes. And I grew up just interested in them. And I ended up doing a lot of other things in my life. I finally ended up at the USGS about 10 years ago. But I think the other event, that other earthquake that really got me thinking about the work that I do today is the 1994 Northridge earthquake was pretty significant in Los Angeles history for a lot of different reasons. And I was living in Southern California at the time in the Pasadena area. And what happened was I experienced the earthquake, and at the time I was taking a geology course at Pasadena City College here in nearby Caltech, nearby where I work, and I had a professor who gave us a tour of the seismo lab, and she took us up the back door and up the, you know, to see everything and also the media center where people report after earthquakes. Well, shortly after this course ended, I was the earthquake happened, and I ended up saying, "Well, I want to go down to Caltech to see what's going on." So I remembered how my professor got us in the building, and so I got in the back door, same door. It was open, like it's not open anymore. It's not the way they do it anymore. But I got in the back door and I went upstairs, and I got into the room where the media was interfacing with the people who I actually now work with, and some people have retired. Actually, the person who hired me, Lucy Jones, was in the room talking, and I sat there for 4 hours, and I just listened to the interaction between the public and the media. And for me, that was inspirational because I want to do this.
Well, there you were. I mean, right, like during the aftermath of an event, right, and just seeing how this is playing out with the importance of science communication, right.
Absolutely, yes. You know, everything, the approach she was using, of course, I've known Lucy for years and years and years, and just to watch that in real time, and, you know, aftershocks were happening while we were in the room, and, you know, there were things coming in, they were analyzing data on the spot, and it, for me, is like, wow, and I'm actually doing that now, so it's great.
That's amazing. And those were the good old days in the 90s when you could kind of sneak in a back door. Things were maybe a little less secure. It sounds like for you, though, this solidified, this is a passion for you and you want to pursue it professionally.
Yes, absolutely.
So, Bob, you and your team you're the operations team lead for the USGS Managed Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning System, a public safety system that's serving more than 50 million people in California, Oregon, and Washington. Could you share with us a little bit about how the system works?
Yes. Shake Alert is America's earthquake early warning system. It's the only public earthquake early warning system in this country. It's California, Oregon, and Washington, and on the order of 50 million people. And the principles of earthquake early warning have been around for years. It just is that the technology had to catch up with it. And it's this idea of catching an earthquake in the act as soon as we can. So in other words, the earthquake begins, earthquakes happen many miles beneath the earth. So the moment that the earthquake reaches the surface, we pick up the ground motion and then move that information to a processing center, which then within a matter of a second or two, or maybe a few seconds, processes that information and then provides really three critical pieces of information: the earthquake's location, the earthquake's size, the magnitude, and also the shaking that could occur around that earthquake. And to appreciate this idea is that it's a striking a balance between speed and accuracy. It's what it's all about. So we're using about a couple of heartbeats worth of data, like a second worth of data, to determine these early estimates. So really all these are estimates of these three factors: location, size, and shaking. And we package that up in a data package. We call that a shake alert message. It's a envelope filled with this data. And then we hand it off to all of these partners that we work with, like Google and Metrolink in Los Angeles, BART in the Bay Area, and others, who then take that data and then they use it to do something like slowing trains, or opening a firehouse door, or protecting a water system, or, as many people have experienced, millions of people have experienced over the last several years in the three shake alert states, are alerts being delivered to their phones.
Bob, so you mentioned that this can be detected very quickly, maybe in a second or two. I wanted to ask you, over time, like say 10, 15, 20 seconds into a quake, does the information become more accurate? And then can you use that to like even improve the messaging from there?
Yeah, so there's a spectrum or an ecosystem of information products that the U.S. Geological Survey publishes. It's through something called the Advanced National Seismic System, and Shake Alert is one of those products. So if we just talk about what Shake Alert is doing, and it really has a very narrow role within the larger scope of earthquake information products, but its role is to detect that earthquake as soon as it can, and then over the course, let's say it's an earthquake that's fairly large. Most earthquakes are over in seconds. That's really the way it is. But let's take a magnitude 7.8 earthquake that starts on the San Andreas Faults, starting down near the Salton Sea, south of Palm Springs, and progresses north about 180 miles up to the northern part of Los Angeles County. That takes about 90 seconds or so for the rupture to move from south to north. So over the course of that rupture, the system continues to monitor that earthquake in real time as that rupture progresses, because there's a consequence is that the more fault that breaks, the bigger the earthquake is. So we can get a sense of updating that information. So yes, so what we do, because our technical partners, the people who actually deliver the alerts, are monitoring this. They're getting information from the system in real time, up to two updates per second. And then what they do is they can also, so if let's say the earthquake grows in size, they would also increase the size of who they would actually deliver the alerts to. So it's that ongoing communication. Now, after, you know, a minute or so, you know, Shake Alert has done its thing, and then other things take over, other information sources than people use to send first responders to, like shake maps and things like that.
Bob, looking at some of the physical parameters of earthquakes, like the different kind of waves, like P waves and S waves, could you explain what those mean to our listeners and why that helps with early warning systems?
Yeah, and so one thing to really realize is that Shake Alert utilizes physics of the earth that we've known for years. And again, we really needed to develop the technology, we needed to develop the software, so we have these algorithms, these earthquake detection algorithms that are sort of at the under the hood stuff that do the detection and the characterization super fast. But we've known that P waves travel, you know, at about, you know, in the order of 4 miles per second, and S waves travel about 2 miles per second. I mean, that's just a round number, but we know that S waves travel about half as fast as P waves. And really, and also what we know about S waves is that they tend to cause more damage. They're the ones that really we want to watch out for. So when we think of shake alert sometimes, and sometimes I characterize it as kind of a race, the P wave gets the thing started, gets the process started. We detect the P wave as soon as it reaches the surface, and then everything goes into motion, because what we want to do is we want to get the alerts out before that strongest shaking arrives. In fact, that's what our goal is to get information to people and to systems before the strongest shaking arrives, and that generally arrives with the S waves.
So essentially, people are warned that the more destructive wave is on its way, and hopefully that they have a little time to prepare and mitigate damages.
Yeah, we know that people can take a protective action like drop cover and hold on in a matter of just a couple of seconds. And so that's in our messaging. That's embedded in all our messagings. If you feel shaking or if you get an alert, drop cover and hold on. And this is behavior people have already known for years. I mean, we have this thing called the Great Shakeout, which has been going on since 2008. And, you know, drop cover and hold on if you feel shaking. Well, what we're doing now is you can get an alert before that strongest shaking arrives and then take that action.
Bob, is there like an optimal geography where shake alert works the best? Like, I would imagine if you're really close to the epicenter, you might not have that much difference in time between the P and S waves. If you're really far from the epicenter, you might not even really feel the quake or no impacts. Is there kind of like a middle, like Goldilocks zone where you're going to get some impact, but there's also enough distance between or time difference between the P and S waves that you have more time to get the message out?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and this is why we want to use the messaging if you feel shaking or if you get an alert to drop cover and hold on, because the issue is that, and there are hundreds of faults. I mean, you look at the Los Angeles Basin. I refer to it as if a stone hits your windshield and your car, and you just shattered it like a spiderweb pattern. That's kind of what the subsurface of the LA Basin looks like. It's shattered like a windshield. And there are faults everywhere, earthquakes all the time. So the chances that you may be close to where that earthquake happens, you know, could be possible. So you may feel the shaking all happen at once. And so you won't have time to get the alert. The system is not fast enough. There was an earthquake in the middle of April of last year, down in Julian, sort of northeast of San Diego. And of course, that's about 100 miles from here. And of course, the people in San Diego and Ramona and those areas felt they were shaking almost immediately. But here in Pasadena, we had about 15 seconds or so, about that amount of time, before anything happened. Now, I had gotten the alert well ahead of time, and I was already under my desk, and the shaking arrived. And so, yeah, a lot of it has to do with distance. You know, if you're super close to the epicenter, you're going to feel that shaking immediately. Farther away, more time.
Bob, you talked about you got the alert and you got under your desk. So let's talk about what can people do when they get an alert. I mean, what are the few things that they can do in that short amount of time?
Yeah. So we have two sort of things that we discuss, right? We talk to people that shake alert is going to trigger automated systems like slowing down Metrolink trains. It could turn on the alert people in hospital security at a hospital here in Los Angeles or whatever. And those systems could do what they're going to do without human intervention. The messaging that we have on the screen that shows up on one screen has what to do, drop cover and hold on. And you can do that fast. And we want to do is we don't want to give people a lot of time to, like, you know, make all these decisions. This is what we want people to practice. But the idea is that giving them very simple things about what to do in that moment, and that's the protective action, drop cover and hold on. That can happen fast.
Yeah, and like you said, I think if you keep the message simple, like, people say, okay, I can do that in just seconds, right?
Yeah, and we know this. And so one thing, we're talking a lot about the technical stuff around shake alert, but we commit a lot of resources to the social science of earthquake early warning. And of course, we're drawing on other literatures, and we have this whole, and almost every paper that we publish is available for free on shakealert.org, our website. And what we're trying to understand is how do people interact with technological systems, and specifically shake alert, and things that are asking you to do something fast, right? So what we're really trying to optimize, and we study a lot of the communication, and we look at closed circuit television information about what people are actually doing. We want them to take those actions quickly so that they can be safe. But it requires us to understand how people learn and what is the best way to communicate this information?
I like that you're, you know, focused so much on the social science, right? It's really interesting to see what people do when they get a warning or, you know, for other hazards, an evacuation statement or things like that. It sounds like that helps you then get an idea of what people may do with the message once they receive it.
Yeah. And you know, people always ask me, well, what's next for Shake Alert? And, you know, the thing that most people don't realize is that we have 40 social scientists working with us, on the order of 40, even more, from all over the world that we're studying this issue about, you know, everything from messaging to appropriate education to everything from optimizing messaging. I mean, we're always thinking about this stuff.
Well, and that's a tremendous amount of focus on social science. And we see a lot with science that we have to go beyond the physical realm of science into understanding the impacts, human behavior, all those types of things. As we're talking about some of these partners, and from research partners to operations partners, could you explain to us who are some of the main partners that USGS and Shake Alert works with to get the message out?
Yes, we're a massive community of folks. And of course, the three major organizations within, of course, the USGS is involved, but we work very closely with our state emergency management agency. So in California, it's the California Governor's Office of Emergency Services and their equivalents in Oregon and Washington, and also the state geological surveys. So they're involved in not only just the sort of administration of it, but the idea is that it's the emergency managers who are going to be really involved after the earthquake is over. But then we also have four universities, Caltech, UC Berkeley, University of Oregon, and University of Washington. And they're actually involved in operations, but also very heavily involved in looking at what's next. Where is Shake Alert Earthquake Early Warning going in the future? And they're doing a lot of the research.
No, I love that. It sounds like there's an operation side, but it's also research-based as well.
Absolutely.
Bob, I just wanted to tiptoe back into the physical science one last time. There's something I have to ask you. A lot of times when we hear about an earthquake on the news, we see an epicenter. It almost looks like the earthquake was a point, and then you see these concentric circles. But you were talking before about these really elongated rupture areas. Is it more accurate in places like Southern California sometimes to think about an earthquake as a rupture zone or a linear feature as opposed to a point on the map?
It all depends on the size of the earthquake. So, you know, our main algorithm that we use for earthquake detection is really focused on those smaller earthquakes that happen in very small areas. When you start, the earthquake starts growing in size, and I use the example of magnitude 7.8 rupture in Southern California, that is a rupture, a line along the fault that's 180 miles long. You need to break that much fault to release that much energy to have an earthquake that size.
I understand. Yeah. So it really has to do with the magnitude.
Yeah, it really has to do with that. And most earthquakes, you know, we have what on the order of 50 earthquakes a day in California. Most of them are tiny or barely feelable, so to speak.
Bob, are there concerns with infrastructure or technology damage maybe near the epicenter, you know, cell phone towers going down, things like that, that would impede these warnings getting out? I mean, you mentioned before more of the damage happens in the S waves and those are slower, so hopefully people would at least get a warning before a cell phone tower is damaged or something like that. Or are there things people should think about, though, as far as their technology use with getting an earthquake warning?
Absolutely. And so this is one thing. So a major part of our operation, a major part of our community are our technical partners, the ones who actually use the data that's produced from the Shake Alert system. They use our data, and they end up using it to do things with it. And what we're looking at them to do is to diversify their ways of delivering alerts to end users. So yes, a lot of them are being delivered currently by things like by the cell networks to phones. And a lot of it is the technology and also the approach that alerting is used determines the currency of Shake Alert is something called latency. We want to shrink the time between when we detect the earthquake and when something gets to you, right? And so different technologies have different latencies associated with it. And then we also look at dependencies of the way those alerts are delivered through a cell phone or whatever. So we're looking at other ways of getting alerts out. And one of the ways that sort of is less dependent on the cell system is something called data casting. And this is actually utilizing FM, AM television frequencies to deliver alerts to dedicated boxes. So there's a way for people to get, you know, alerts through other means. Also automated systems. I mean, we're working with schools and other places that alerts are delivered through the internet over a PA system. So what we want to try to do is, and one of the phrases we use is by every pathway possible, is a way to for people to get as many alerts. People always ask me, well, like, hey, which app should I put on my phone or which way should I get alerts on my phone? And I say, get them all. Because you know what? I've gotten alerted for many earthquakes over the years since I started in this. And I'm happy to get alerts from more than one provider. In some cases, one provider gave me an alert and another one didn't. And I don't know why, but at least I have a little bit of a backup.
So it sounds like there's some wisdom in having redundancy. If you're getting two or three notifications for a big event, right? What's the harm? It sounds like you're saying that these could play out differently in different events.
Absolutely. And this is where the social science comes into play, right? Because we want the messaging, what is said in those messages. If you get three messages, they all got to kind of say the same thing. And so we work very closely with our partners to make sure that they're not like that. One partner is saying drop carbon, hold on. The other one's saying get under the doorway, which is not a good idea. We make sure they all say the same thing.
I see what you're saying. So there, it sounds like there's really, it's important to have consistency in messaging from all the partners.
Absolutely. Yes. And that's something that we're talking about all the time and we're always trying to optimize that. And you know, one thing is that we always tell people too, and this is actually part of one of our other products, is that, and we've seen this in many earthquakes, even in Southern California recently, is that there are aftershocks and the aftershocks are sizable, right? So what we try to also convey to people is that, yeah, you may get this alert, you may feel the shaking, but remember, be ready for more shaking because it can still go on. Yeah.
Well, and let's talk about this, Bob. So it sounds like in some earthquakes, you're going to have a series of impacts that may take over an extended period of time. Could you talk a little bit about that? I mean, how could that potentially look in different areas?
Well, I'm not completely clear on the question, but I think that one of the things that we are trying to look at is looking at the full spectrum of impacts and sort of possibilities. So, you know, of course, shake alert has a very narrow window of things that it does. It's really, you know, I think of the analogy I use with shake alert is that you go to your favorite bakery in the morning and you get that baguette and it smells wonderful and you crack it open and you start chewing on it and it's the most amazing thing in the world. And you say, you know, that I'm going to go back to the same bakery to get another baguette. And by then, the same baguette tastes terrible. It's stale, right? So shake alert information goes stale pretty quickly. So what we are trying to get, and this is our sort of where we're going with things, is that we have other information products like ShakeMap and Pager and others that can provide better post-earthquake information. So for example, a ShakeMap, which is generally produced, you know, minutes after the earthquake is over, can provide first responders with really important information about where to send first response, areas that were shaken the most. In 1994, this resource did not exist. Now, we knew there was a lot of shaking in the San Fernando Valley, but did we know that there was an area of shaking that was really extensive in Santa Monica, on the other side of the Santa Monica Mountains? No, we didn't know that until people actually went there. Now that shake map can give you that picture right away, well, within minutes after the earthquake.
So, Bob, would it be accurate to say Shake Map is really a great resource for mapping out what happened, but Shake Alert is really separate? It's an early warning system. It's not necessarily a mapping system.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So Shake Alert has its niche, right? And this is what we want to do is we want to see how these products complement one another. So something like Shake Map or even Earthquake Notification Service, people get emails on their, you know, anybody can sign up for it. Is that they get information that happens in the, you know, minutes or so, or maybe a minute or so after the earthquake, where Shake Alert is operating in the realm of seconds.
Yeah, Bob, so Shake Alert is working once an earthquake has occurred. in December, there was a lot of high-profile media in Japan. The Japanese Meteorological Agency issued a mega-quake warning. From what I read in the article in Time magazine, they said there was a 7.5 magnitude event. They thought that could potentially trigger another even larger event. And so it seemed from what I read, and you have the expertise here, so I'm curious what you say, but it seemed like that was more predictive. Like they were predicting maybe a higher probability of an event that has not yet occurred. That's very different than what you do with Shake Alert. What are your thoughts on like predictive things like this? What are the pros and cons? I mean, where are we going in the future with this concept of predictive earthquake risk analysis?
Yeah, and again, the earthquake prediction has been around for a long time, and there have been various flavors of it and sort of various ways of thinking about it. And Shake Alert has always operated on the principle of quick detection and quick processing and getting information out as quickly as possible. Sort of a middle ground between Shake Alert and prediction is something called forecasting. And my colleagues who are in this area may characterize it a little bit different than I do. But earthquake forecasts, much like weather forecasts, are based on many data sources. And so we have had many, you know, projects over the years. One in particular called the Uniform California Earthquake Rupture Forecast, or USURF, which has actually relied on many sources of data from the earthquakes. So the history of earthquakes in the area, people who are digging trenches to look at the fault itself, people using information from GPS, and sort of integrating all of that to get an understanding of what might happen next. So you see these reports like what will happen over the next 30 years or the next 100 years. And certain percentage of chance of an earthquake those size, those have their value. And sort of more on a local level or on more of an earthquake-related level is that for earthquakes that are magnitude 4 or larger, we publish what's called an Operational Aftershock Forecast, or OAF. And that's all available on the event page from an earthquake. And that will tell you, like, over the next week, there is an X percent chance of a magnitude 3 or plus earthquake. Or so on. It gives you information along those lines. And that's just giving you a sense of what, you know, and historically what we know about that area. There are a lot of factors that go into that. So the forecasting part is based more on sort of like, if you've slammed together all this data about what you know about something based on what's happened in the past, you can say that potentially this will happen in the future. Now, of course, Shake Alert is more in the moment, right? We want to like get it moving right away. So that's really where we are. And so we're not completely like leaving prediction aside, although that's not our thing. We are mostly focused on what can we do to get information moving to where it needs to go as quickly as possible.
Well, and Bob, what I love with Shake Alert, I mean, now we have the technology that we can do telecommunication instantaneously across large areas. It opens the opportunity. Why not communicate about that event that's already happened? Because, you know, you go back decades ago, people wouldn't know that they're going to get hit really hard in 8 seconds, right? Or in 25 seconds. It seems like, why not take that opportunity? We know it's already happened. Why not rush that communication out and really mitigate losses?
Right, exactly. And that's the thing, is that, you know, you still have the option if you feel shaking to take that protective action. But if you can get a couple of seconds. And really what we're mostly concerned about, and this has always been something that's been talked about for years, even at the beginnings of the Great Shakeout, is that the longer you wait, the potential of you getting hurt is much, much larger. So the shaking from an event could grow very quickly, and the ability to do what you need to do to protect yourself may not be as easy once that shaking level grows, and that can happen. It doesn't happen to all earthquakes. I mean, most earthquakes are small, but it's a chance to get a little extra time to do what you need to do.
Bob, where do you think we're going as far as the science, products, communication, partnerships, you know, all of this? Where are we going in the next, say, 10 to 15 years?
Yeah, and there's a lot of things that are happening. Of course, we hear about using fiber optic cables for more efficient earthquake detection. And that's one area. Of course, there's been a lot of talk about AI involvement in this as well. And those are all things that are on the table. But one thing that we are extremely sort of concerned about and also very adamant about is that we want to use systems that are proven, systems that we know that will work, systems that are robust. So what we've done in several cases is to, if we're running a sort of a new approach or whatever, we have the system that's operational running in parallel to the one that's testing. So we would never allow something in the wild, so to speak, without it being thoroughly tested and validated. I mean, we've had some interesting innovations over the last several years that really have moved Shake Alert in the right direction. One of them, of course, is that there was a tendency for earthquakes that were very far away called teleseisms that were impacting, were triggering the Shake Alert system. It's happened from time to time, and we've developed techniques to filter out those teleseisms so that we don't get some earthquake in Brazil or in Japan or Indonesia impacting us here in California, Oregon, Washington. The second innovation is the is basically creating a little bit of a safety net. It's called Alert Pause. And basically what it does is it contains, since the estimate is made very quickly, it sort of holds the earthquake estimates of shaking in a within a certain distance for a few seconds, just to make sure that what we're seeing is really what we're seeing. And I think of it as a safety net. And the third area that we've innovated, which I think is maybe a little bit more tangible, is the integration of global positioning system data, geodetic data, into the Shake Alert system. One of the biggest challenges are the largest earthquakes, the earthquakes that are magnitude 7 and larger. And so what we have done recently is integrated effectively very, very, very efficient, very precise global positioning system data into the information output of Shake Alert for the larger earthquakes.
Bob, last year I actually experienced my first international earthquake. I was in Santorini, Greece, right when they were having all that hyperactive seismic activity. And, yeah, and there I was on a park bench and it started shaking. So I started looking into it. I mean, I knew that they had a extensive earthquake history in that part of the world. But as I looked into, you know, research between, say, Greece and Turkey and the United States, I found a lot of research collaborations with scientists in California. Could you see Shake Alert going international, maybe to the Mediterranean, South America, Alaska, Hawaii? I mean, do you think that the system may geographically spread?
I think, and there's been talk about this, the USGS published a report, it's available on shakealert.org, that talks about Shake Alert expansion into Alaska. And that's something, of course, that's been discussed for a while. I think probably the more tangible innovation recently is Canada has rolled out its own early earthquake warning system, and they were operating in British Columbia for years, and then now recently expanded to Ontario and into Quebec, and that system is based very closely on the Shake Alert system. In fact, we do data sharing. I mean, there is, especially with the West Coast and the number of large faults and things like that, there is a need to have cross-border coordination for the largest earthquakes. So the Canadian system in our collaboration with Canada has been extensive and continues, and we work with them all the time. So that's really one of the most tangible things. Now, whether or not it's called Shake Alert, and it's not called Shake Alert in Canada, but it's early warning that's based on the model that we're using. And the Shake Alert system, the one we have on the West Coast, is actually modeled pretty closely to the Japanese system. So there is a lot of sharing that happens internationally, with everything with algorithms to sensing technology to everything else.
Bob, I know our listeners are really going to really enjoy this. We focus in the podcast a lot on things you can do to take action, things you can do to mitigate losses. Our friends, especially in the U.S. West Coast, are really going to enjoy this podcast episode. How can our listeners find you, your research team, anything about Sure. Shake Alert, either online Sure. or also at conferences and workshops?
Yeah, so we have our website, shakealert.org, which has all kinds of information about the Shake Alert system. There's peer-reviewed papers, both in social science and in the technical realm. All of it's available for anyone who wants to partake. But if people are just interested, like, how do I get Shake Alert on my phone? What I really recommend people to do is there's a page on the USGS website, and all they need to do in their browser is just type in Be Shake Alert Safe. Be Shake Alert Safe. And that will take them directly to a page on USGS, or we'll give them a link. We'll show them how to set up their phones to receive Shake Alert powered alerts, to power their phone with Shake Alert, so to speak. And then we also have, we're on X at USGS_ShakeAlert, and you can follow us. And what we do is after, every time there's a Shake Alert system activation that impacts people or systems, we post on our X account at USGS_ShakeAlert. So those are there. And then as far as finding us in other places, we have people who go to conferences like the National Science Teaching Association. We have several presentations there. We're present at like other meetings like the American Geophysical Union. We have that sort of presence in these places. But we also work very closely with our partners in all three states, like the State Emergency Management Agencies, where they'll be giving public safety talks or at safety fairs or other things. We're also in the process of training community emergency response teams, CERT teams, to be able to do work and sharing what ShakeAlert is and what we're doing.
Bob, that's tremendous. It sounds like people can easily find you online, your products as well, and then at conferences and workshops, especially in those three states along the Pacific Coast. Bob, as we wrap up this episode of the GeoTrek podcast, what's one last take-home message you'd like to share with our listeners?
I think a really important thing is, of course, ShakeAlert is an amazing technology, and it's important to know what it can and can't do, but really to understand it's a tool. And our vision is earthquake early warning for all. That's what we say. And it's true. So if you happen to be visiting California for just a day or two, you can still set up your phone to receive ShakeAlert power alerts, visit, basically search for Be ShakeAlert Safe. So it's an important tool. It's going to make your adventures in earthquake country even safer.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for taking time to share about ShakeAlert, to engage with our audience. We trust the work you're doing is going to help save a lot of lives and help reduce financial and economic damage as well. Thanks so much for all you do. And we're going to continue to follow you online and the progress of ShakeAlert in the future.
Thank you. Great to talk with you.
Wow, Bob, so many amazing insights here. We love hearing what you and your team are doing with ShakeAlert. There were actually four main take-home points that I got from this. The first one, we talk about this a lot on the podcast, having multiple ways to receive warning messages, whether it's earthquakes, tornadoes, floods, having multiple notifications, multiple apps. Like Bob shared in the podcast, what harm does it do to have two or three different apps that are going to notify you? Having a redundancy of warning systems, of sources you go to, is only going to help you be better prepared. Number two, I thought it was really interesting. I was thinking of ShakeAlert as a warning system for residents, but Bob mentioned if you're traveling to California or Oregon or Washington, download their app on your phone. You never know when an earthquake is going to hit. It could happen during a business trip, a family vacation. At all times, if you're traveling out to the West Coast, you definitely want ShakeAlert to be in your pocket to warn you of potential earthquakes. I just was amazed by the technological advances. And I was thinking, you know, more than 20 years ago, we could not have had something like ShakeAlert. We all have smartphones in our pockets. This technology that we have instantaneous telecommunications, it's enabling ShakeAlert to actually communicate and outrun earthquakes to get to people to warn them that a damaging quake may be on the way. I was just amazed talking to him about the innovations that we've had over the past two decades or so. And then lastly, I loved his story about sneaking into the earthquake communication emergency messaging meeting uninvited in the 90s. It reminded me that a lot of the people we have on the podcast, a lot of these professionals, this is not a job for them. It's a passion. I mean, they've always wanted to do this kind of engagement and communication to make a difference, to save lives, to reduce losses. Reminds me when I was 14 years old, I actually walked to an airport to find the National Weather Service office because I was so passionate to learn more. They made me a severe weather spotter on the scene. So Bob's story about sneaking into that meeting in the 90s, I loved it. It shows his passion for earthquake knowledge, science, and communication as well. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. Your faithful support to all of our listeners helps make us a top-rated podcast on the topic of natural disasters. So you can always find us online on social media. We're GeoTrek. Definitely make sure you're liking, subscribing, and following to our content online. Understanding and engaging with these stories will help to make you, your family, and your community better prepared for natural disasters. I'm the host of the GeoTrek podcast, Hurricane Hal, and we'll catch you on the next episode of the GeoTrek podcast.